Welcome to the deep dive.
Oh.
Today, we're diving headfirst into a legal case that's just a fantastic example of why precision in business agreements is absolutely critical, especially when you're talking about, you know, joining forces.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at B. Lewis Productions, Inc. v. Maya Angelou.
Mm-hmm.
Now, understanding why this, well, seemingly straightforward letter agreement between a production company and the legendary Maya Angelou ultimately failed to create a legal joint venture, that's going to be incredibly valuable.
Exactly. The core question we're tackling today is really this. What went wrong? Why didn't that signed letter agreement stand up as a legally binding joint venture? We've dug through the court documents and some pretty sharp legal analysis to bring you the essential takeaways.
Yeah, for you, our listener, our mission is clear. We're going to extract the crucial elements that make a joint venture legally solid, explore the safety net of alternative legal arguments, like this concept called Quantum Meruit,
yeah.
Yeah. And arm you with a practical understanding of how to approach drafting and even litigating business deals. Think of this as your rapid rundown of some really key contract law principles. Okay, let's unpack this.
All right, let's set the stage. Back in 1994, B. Lewis Productions, or BLP, and Maya Angelou put pen to paper on a letter agreement. The idea was basically Angelou would bring her literary works to the table,
right,
and BLP would take the reins on managing licensing opportunities, particularly for things like greeting cards. Now, this initial agreement, it was a bit light on specifics. Critically, it didn't clearly lay out how they would share losses.
Okay.
And the duration of their arrangement wasn't really pinned down either. It simply stated, you know, they'd operate under this letter until a more formal document was created.
So fast forward a bit, and BLP goes out and does the heavy lifting. They successfully negotiate a licensing deal with none other than Hallmark Cards on Angelou's behalf. Seems like things are progressing smoothly, right?
That's what you might assume. But here's the twist. Angelou ultimately decided against signing the agreement with Hallmark. Her reasons reportedly had to do with her dissatisfaction with BLP's handling of matters.
Hmm.
Then, adding another layer, she later ended her business relationship with BLP altogether and, remarkably, partnered directly with Hallmark.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah.
So BLP, feeling understandably left out after putting in the work, decides to take legal action. They're claiming breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, because they believed a joint venture had been established.
Right. They thought they had a JV.
And even sued Hallmark for tortious interference, essentially arguing Hallmark interfered with their business relationship with Angelou.
Mm-hmm.
And Angelou didn't just stand by. She filed a counterclaim against BLP, alleging fraud.
Right. So the case goes to court. And at the initial district court level, the judge ruled in favor of Angelou and Hallmark without a full trial. The key finding was that no legally enforceable joint venture had actually been created by that initial letter agreement. However, and this is a crucial procedural point, the appellate court later sent the case back to the lower court specifically to consider this concept of quantum merit. The question they wanted answered was whether BLP deserved some form of compensation, almost like a finder's fee,
right,
for identifying and securing that Hallmark opportunity for Angelou, even if a formal, legally sound joint venture wasn't actually in place.
Okay, so let's really get to the core issue. Why did the court decide that letter wasn't a joint venture? What were the essential missing pieces?
Well, under both New York and North Carolina law, which governed this case, a joint venture has certain fundamental elements. And the letter agreement just didn't meet that legal standard. One of the most significant shortcomings was the issue of profit and loss sharing.
Both?
Yes, both. The law in these places generally mandates a mutual agreement to share both profits and losses. The letter between BLP and Angelou had only mentioned profits. It was totally silent on the crucial aspect of who would bear the financial risks if things went south. So remember this, a true joint venture involves shared risk.
That makes perfect sense. You can't just agree to split the rewards and, you know, leave someone else holding the bag if things take a downturn. What else was missing for a legally sound joint venture?
Another key element that was absent was clear evidence of joint control. From the details presented, it really appeared that Angelou retained substantial, maybe even complete, authority over the project. BLP didn't seem to have the kind of operational decision-making power typical of a genuine joint venture.
So more like a manager than a partner.
Potentially, yeah. Or at least not a partner with equal control in the eyes of the law for JV purposes. Finally, and this is important for drafting agreements, the letter lacked definiteness on several other essential terms. No clear provision for termination, no specific duration, no details on initial financial contributions or other fundamental aspects of how they'd actually operate. As the court pointed out, look, an agreement doesn't need to spell out every single tiny detail, but the essential terms, those cannot be left vague.
So, because it wasn't recognized as a legal joint venture, BLP's other legal claims, they essentially just fell apart.
Precisely, yes. Because think about it. The fiduciary duties BLP claimed Angelou violated, those would have arisen from the existence of a joint venture. If no joint venture existed legally.
And no special duty.
Generally, yeah, no inherent fiduciary relationship between the parties in this specific business context. Similarly, the claim against Hallmark for tortious interference, that hinged on a valid contract, the joint venture agreement. If that agreement wasn't legally sound,
then there was no contract for Hallmark to interfere with. Makes sense.
Exactly. At least not based on that specific JV theory.
And what about Angelou's counterclaim? Her argument that BLP had committed fraud?
The court didn't buy that either. They essentially concluded Angelou understood the terms of the letter agreement when she signed it. Her claim of unilateral mistake also didn't hold up. So yeah, across the board, BLP's initial legal strategy based on the joint venture existing didn't succeed.
But you mentioned this wild card quantum merit. What exactly is that? And why was the appellate court so keen for the lower court to look at it? This sounds important.
This is where it gets really interesting and honestly potentially very useful for you in your future legal understanding. Quantum merit is a legal principle rooted in fairness and equity. It literally translates to as much as deserved.
Okay.
It's a way for a court to provide a remedy when one party has provided services, the other party has accepted those services and benefited, but there isn't a formal enforceable contract. The fundamental idea behind it is to prevent unjust enrichment, one party unfairly getting a benefit without paying for it.
So in this specific situation, connecting the dots,
yeah.
Even though the letter didn't create a joint venture, BLP did invest time and effort negotiating with Hallmark.
Mm-hmm.
And Angelou ultimately benefited from that initial connection when she later partnered with Hallmark directly. Is that the underlying reasoning?
Exactly. The appellate court recognized that BLP had potentially provided valuable services by identifying and cultivating the Hallmark opportunity. Angelou accepted those efforts, at least initially, and ultimately reaped the benefits. So the court reasoned, even without a valid joint venture agreement, BLP might still be entitled to some reasonable compensation for the value of those services.
Like a finder's fee, as you said.
Pretty much, yeah. Akin to a finder's fee, a legal recognition they brought a valuable opportunity to the table. This is a really significant point, especially if you're involved in any kind of business dealings. Even if your initial agreement isn't perfect, if you provide a service that's accepted and benefits the other party, you might still have a legal avenue to recover something.
So for our listeners, especially law students or anyone involved in business agreements, what are the real key takeaways from this case? Let's boil it down.
Okay, several crucial lessons here. First and foremost, when you are aiming to establish a joint venture, the significance of using clear and specific language, well, it just cannot be emphasized enough. You absolutely must include explicit terms outlining how profits and, critically, losses will be shared.
That loss sharing again.
Absolutely crucial. You need to clearly define roles and responsibilities, including the extent of joint control, and you must have clarity on duration and termination conditions. Leaving these fundamental elements vague, that significantly increases the risk your agreement won't be seen as a joint venture by a court.
Right. It sounds like the absence of a loss sharing provision was really a major, maybe the major stumbling block here.
It really was. Under both New York and North Carolina law, that mutual agreement to share in the losses is often considered a non-negotiable requirement for a joint venture. Without it, courts are highly unlikely to recognize the arrangement as such.
Okay. And the other crucial takeaway is more about legal strategy, right?
Hmm.
What should you think about if you find yourself in a situation where a formal agreement might be, well, shaky?
Absolutely. From a litigation standpoint, this case really underscores the importance of pleading alternative legal theories. Even if your main claim, like breach of contract based on a JV agreement, doesn't succeed, right, you might still have a viable claim for quantum merit. If you can show you provided valuable services, they were accepted, they benefited the other party, and it would be unjust enrichment if you weren't compensated.
You might still recover something.
Exactly. It's about having that equitable safety net built into your legal arguments.
Just imagine for a moment, if that initial letter had simply stated something like, Any net losses will be shared equally between BLP and Angelo. Just that one sentence. Could that have potentially changed the whole outcome regarding the joint venture question?
It very well could have. I mean, the inclusion of a loss-sharing provision, along with maybe more clarity on control and duration, would have significantly strengthened BLP's argument that a legally binding joint venture was in place. It really highlights how critical those seemingly minor details can be in the eyes of the law.
And here's another hypothetical. What if Angelou had ended the relationship with BLP right in the middle of those hallmark negotiations, before a final deal was reached? Could quantum erruit still have been relevant for BLP then?
Oh, absolutely. In that scenario, BLP could have argued, look, we already provided valuable services by initiating and progressing these talks with Hallmark. Angelou would be unjustly enriched if she could just step in, take over those negotiations, maybe finalize a deal based on our groundwork without compensating us for those prior efforts.
Got it.
So yeah, quantum erruit provides a potential legal lifeline even when the formal contract framework is incomplete or breaks down prematurely.
So to wrap things up for everyone listening, this case truly serves as a cautionary tale, a letter of intent. A preliminary agreement. It might show good faith, sure, but it doesn't automatically create a legally enforceable contract, especially for something complex like a joint venture.
Precisely. You need that clear, unambiguous language, especially around those core elements, profit loss sharing, control, duration. And if things do go sideways, remember the potential power of pleading quantum erruit. You might just have a legal basis to recover some value for the work you put in, even without a perfect contract.
Okay, final thought to really chew on. Think about the broader implications here.
Mm-hmm.
Any situation where informal agreements come before formal contracts, maybe a potential partnership, a freelance project, even just helping a friend with a business idea, what proactive steps can you take to make sure your preliminary discussions don't leave you legally vulnerable or without recourse for your efforts down the line? Definitely something crucial to reflect on. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.